I shamelessly promoted myself, so
so what do you expect?
And my name is Harriet. I'm an alcoholic. And is this going out right?
Yeah.
Because it sounds weird over here. I'm an addict also. And this is an open meeting, right? Okay, good. I just want to make sure I don't step on anybody's toes. Let's see here. I told my story last year, so you're wondering why I'm back up here again, and I'm not sure. Tim, for some reason, likes me to talk about it, so we probably want you to make a nice donation after when the baskets are being passed around. So looking for new methods to support NAPA. Let me start with the story. I'm born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and today is a special day for our city, because of Martin Luther King, and for the whole country, and the world probably, so that's kudos for Atlanta, and tomorrow's going to be a big day for everybody, and I hope it all works out the way it's supposed to work out. I'm sure it will. I used to tell my story in a chronological order, and today I'm going to try to, so I can get more of the recovery part into the story, I'm going to start in the middle. How many people in here have less than 90 days? 60 days, 90 days? I think most people are more sober than that. Okay, good. You know, when I got here, I knew I was an alcoholic. I definitely knew I was a cocaine addict and a drug addict. But what I couldn't understand is how I was going to fit in with you folks. You know, that's the problem for me. The real problem is it wasn't that I knew I was an alcoholic. It wasn't that I didn't know that I was a drug addict. But it was, how am I going to be like you guys? Because I wasn't anything like you guys. You know, I was, a small-time dope dealer, a pretty good, met women rather easily in my drug days. You know, drugs is a powerful seduction. Was fairly successful in the ventures that I did. And, I got here. I remember going to the Biscayne room. I sat in there just saying, what is this? I mean, I need to get sober because I did a tour to Petrie Hospital, but I just could not relate to what was going on here. I mean, I danced at the NAPA Club. And I mean, God almighty, it's just... It's still difficult for me to imagine, but I am grateful to be here. You know, so I want to start when I first heard the real message. I was 37 years old. I was in Charter Petrie Hospital in July July of 91, and I had to be there. I mean, I was on dangerous ground. It was either do something stupid, even though I didn't think I could do that, or get some help. I just needed to be locked up. Now, I needed to be locked up for two reasons. I needed to be locked up because I was lock-up-able, and my family needed to have me locked up so they could get a good night's sleep. And I believe that's what treatment facilities are for anyway, for the family members, not for the addict themselves. I was in there. While I was in there, I was at a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. Now, I went to AA meetings, I went to Cocaine Anonymous meetings, and I was at this particular meeting was a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, and there was a guy in the meeting, there was a lady by, they used to call her Shaky Pam, and the guy was a guy by the name of, I'll just use his last name, Manley, and Shaky Pam was the chairperson, and Manley was the discussion leader, and Shaky Pam is introducing the discussion leader, very much like what we do at all our meetings here, and she introduces this guy, this wiry guy, and this guy goes on this little story about what he used to be like, and how life changed for him because of Cocaine Anonymous, and I'm looking at this guy, and the whole time I'm listening to him talk, I'm trying to think, where do I know this guy from? I know this guy. Turns out that he was from South Georgia, so there was no way that I could know him, but I knew this guy. And while that meeting was going on, there was a guy in the back of the room. And this guy started to talk, and he said his name, and I looked back, and it was a guy I used to get high with. And this guy didn't know I was in the room, and all he was talking about was this big book. how to toughen that thing, you know, just big book this, big book that, and, you know, so, you know, but I had a little warm feeling towards him because I knew who he was, and I was thinking to myself, well, if he has an answer, maybe this can work out for me. And, you know, so I was in Pittsburgh for another couple of days, and, you know, they told me that for me to continue to stay there was going to be like $30,000. So I said, well, I really do want to stay. Do you have any scholarships? And they didn't have any scholarships, but they offered me the next plan down, which was outpatient treatment. You know, it was a little more affordable. So, you know, I went to outpatient treatment. That didn't last for 2 or 3 days because I chartered Pittsburgh Hospital. It was right around the corner from a neighborhood that I like to go to visit. Now, so that was my first introduction to this thing. You know, and everything was going downhill rapidly from there. And in September of 91, which is a couple of months later, I was still doing the stuff that I was doing. I was buying crack cocaine, and I was in Linwood Park, and Doc, who used to travel, who's my better half over here of over 2 decades, God bless her, she went out of town. I picked up a white chip on a Friday night. She went out of town. Monday I was back trying to do the things that I like to do, what I needed to do, excuse me. And I tried to rip the guy off for 2 hits of the crack, and he beat the living shit out of me. I mean, he just put me on my knees and beat me to what I thought was near my death. You know, I don't know what it would be like now, but I was on my knees begging for my life. And, you know, when I got back home, this was the interesting part of it, is I, as hurt as I was much more interested in killing the son of a bitch. And that's not me. I'm not that kind of person. And, you know, I tried to get some people up a posse to go on out there and find this guy. And it didn't happen, and I ended up in the hospital. And a few days later, I'm in Decatur Hospital, and I'm not in the ward for treatment yet, but I was downstairs, and I wasn't getting treated the way I thought I should be treated. You know, I thought they were looking at me as a junkie that was just a loser, and they weren't giving me the attention I needed. And this doctor, his name was Dr. Allard, and he had long hair and a long beard. He came down to visit me from the fourth floor or third floor, whatever floor it was that they take you up to. And he talked to me. I don't remember a word he said. Then I watched an episode of The Simpsons, and I cried all the way through it because it was an episode, and I'm not going to go into the episode, but the fact of the matter is I just didn't know who I was anymore. I just had lost all identity, and it wasn't that I was filled with shame, and it wasn't anything, because I didn't give a shit about nobody. That I had lost whatever was Harry, was gone. And the next day, I was supposed to check up into that hospital, and I walked out of that hospital. I had some type of experience where some type of decision that was sufficient for me to get my ass up out of there and go do something different took place that night. And I found my own outpatient treatment program at Northside Hospital. I went to that. I started coming to this NAVA club, and I was very involved in Cocaine Anonymous at Northside Hospital. Now, we met at Northside Hospital back then. And, you know, I got involved, and my life's been different from that. And I'm going to come back to the rest of the story from there. I want to just explain where I come from, a little bit about me. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. My father's grocery store, he bought when I was born, is on Simpson Street at the corner of Simpson and Sunset. That's the same street that Coretta Scott King raised her children. And, you know, Martin lived on that street, so I was a quarter mile from it. Now, that's not that big a deal in that sense. It was also the civil rights movement was going up around us. And, I mean, the civil rights movement was serious business. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but my father's grocery store got burned down two times. There was a lot of robberies, which was not anything to do with that, but it was just the neighborhood. And it was a tough neighborhood, but my father, you know, wanted to make a good living to raise his children. The other important factor in my life that I really thought was important, and it probably was, is that both my parents are Holocaust survivors. So my parents my mom was in a camp for 6 years, my father was in the work camps, so I don't know which of them had it worse. but neither of them did them well. And the worst part about it is that they didn't seek any treatment for their problems when they came to the United States. And my mom, one good part of it was my mom got a check every month from the German government for about 40 years. And, you know, when they were starting out in the United States, that wasn't a bad deal to get a check of $300 every month. And you know, so you could, you know, do things back in the late 40s, $300 a month check wasn't bad. They went to Iowa, then they ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was born in 1954 at Georgia Baptist Hospital on Boulevard. And, yeah, I had a good childhood, you know. My mom and dad worked hard so that we could have whatever we needed. I had every opportunity that anybody would ever want. I mean, all the way up until I was, you know, about 50 years old. I mean, they were good, you know what I mean? So, I started getting high when I was about 16 years old. I can't exactly remember my first drink, but, you know, I think it was a Swiss malt liquor in my father's grocery store. Now, if you see me leaning over this thing here, I'm having back surgery in 2 weeks, and so I've been pretty much pain here. So I'm good for about 20 minutes. So if I lean over, I'm not nodding out. I drank, but that wasn't really the thing. When I really started drinking alcoholically was right after Gidco. My brother was in a fraternity down at Georgia State University, and every week they would drink this purple passion stuff. They take grain alcohol, mix it with grape juice, and it's a powerful concoction. And my buddies and I would, every Friday and Saturday, we would enjoy this stuff. And I mean, we drank to get drunk. There was a group of us, we called ourselves the four of us, and they drank, but they didn't drink like I drank. I drank to get high. And I was predestined to be an alcoholic drug addict. I think my first high really is that when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I used to hold my breath until I would almost pass out. And it gave you a hell of a sensation. And all the kids would be running to their parents or, oh, look at Harry, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of liked the attention probably. And, so when I got to 16, 17, I'm drinking this stuff. And then I went to a wedding in Montreal, Canada. My cousin, which if you ever want to hear an interesting story, you ought to hear his story. So I'm not going to tell it. Montreal, just remember Montreal, Canada. Okay. But I smoked my first joint up there. I was 16, my brother was 21, and now I felt like a man, you know what I mean? So I smoked my first joint, and then I came back to Atlanta and started stealing from my father, from his grocery store money. I used to count the money on every Sunday. And then I was able to start buying reefer and selling reefer at my high school, and that kind of made me feel good. I was a somebody, because part of my problem was when I was in high school and elementary school, I was a real little kid. I mean, real little. I mean, I was like 5 feet tall. I went to a growth doctor one time, a hormone doctor. We go in, my mom and I, to this growth doctor, and the guy's like 4'6", you know. I ain't kidding, you know, but obviously he had an interest in his field. And so where was I? Oh yeah, I was having a drink. So I mean, but I drank, I smoked weed for this or that. I can tell you that I started using cocaine. Okay, well, I want to get back to you. My drug of choice, my first drug of choice, I mean, now, mind you, as you're saying, like, this guy's talking a lot about drugs, but if you know me, and if you have any problems with whether I'm an alcoholic or not, you can ask Dot after the story. I always drank alcohol, but I always did these other things, and my drug of choice, first drug of choice was not the Quaaludes, it was Quaaludes, and it was, a hell of a drug. They actually banned it eventually, and I could eat a lot of them, and I sold a lot of them. One thing about drug dealing is that if you're doing it on a small time, whoever's selling it above you seems to find you, you know. So you seem like you have a steady course all the time. And Quaaludes was a drug that made me very popular. I mean, I was very popular. When I walked into a room at a party, I was the man. I mean, it was like a pretty escort. You know what I mean? Just I was the man. You know, so it's powerful. you know, to be able to walk in the room and people love you and want you. I also was a full-time pot smoker. Now, I smoked pot for 20 years every day, all day long. Like, people smoked cigarettes. That was a side chick to everything. That was not even a question or that. That was just the way that was. So I went to my Quaalude stage on my 21st birthday. A couple of brothers I was involved with. This guy was a gelato junkie. He shot me up some cocaine, and I was at a PJ's at a bar, and I drank lots of what I want. So I shot the cocaine, shot in there with great syringes. He shoots the cocaine in me. I'm drinking lots of 101, one after another, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I mean, I felt good. And, you know, then it just went on from there. I mean, you know, I could never finish college. I was a 7-year college student. And I flunked out after 7 years, you know, less than 2.0. I got a story about getting shipped to Israel that I'll get to, but when I came back from Israel, I actually went back to college, and that was just a bad idea. You know, college was not for me. And, what happened to me was I was doing these Quaaludes, and they were breaking the law. They were going to quit making them, and my family was now hip to the deal. They knew I had problems, but they were real hip to the deal about these Quaaludes. And I would sit in my parents' house while I was living there, but I would sit in my parents' house, and I could not think, move. I was violently depressed that I could not get the drug of choice that I wanted. It was just unbelievable. It was the most terrible thing. And that was my first experience with a hospital. I was put into West Paces Ferry Hospital that's no longer here, and I had a psychiatrist who died of drugs and bullshit, but he died after I left, you know, so, but huge whack, I mean, you know, so, I mean, I can mention his name, and you can look him up on Google, and you know he was whack, but I'm not, but he put me in West Paces Ferry Hospital. I lasted there for about 3 days, and called up my mom, said I was about to check out, and my mom says, hey, you never finish anything. I said, but mom, these people are crazy, you know, and they were crazy. I was not on a drug floor. I was on a mentally ill floor, you know, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on up there. So I checked myself out at AMA, and I came home, and my parents were pissed off. And probably less than a week later, I was on my way to Israel with a one-way ticket. They weren't planning on seeing me back. You know? They've given me $500 and a one-way ticket to Israel. And yeah, that's how Jewish people treat alcoholism. So I get to Israel, and, you know, the $500 didn't last more than 2 days. And, you know, I'm at a place called looking for a kibbutz, and that's a collective farm where people live. And I found this one called an olpan where they teach you language, because I was valued over there, too, because I was Jewish, and they wanted me to stay. You know what I mean? That's the Jewish people don't convert people to be Jewish, but if you're Jewish, they want you there. You know, so I was over there, and, you know, I was there about 6 to 8 weeks before I could actually function. And I lost my depression, and I was moving forward, and I was, you know, doing the work. And I was in this old time, which was I was studying Hebrew. Now, I had gone to private Hebrew school, so I was pretty good on that stuff. Except I didn't want to be in school. I didn't have the patience for that. So I was able to get moved into working with the sheep. And I was working with it. They had a big sheep farm there, and I got to work there, which was an honor, believe it or not, because they didn't let too many people do it. And I got up there, and I'm a hard worker. I'm a hell of a worker. And, you know, that's the nice thing about Israel and one of these farms is that here in this country, you're not judged for how hard you work. You're judged for how much money you have. Over there, it was different. They don't judge you for your money. They judge you for your ability to take care of your business and work. And I was able to do that over there, and it was great. I worked. I did that for about a year and 6 months. I also picked cotton, fished. I mean, I did everything they wanted us to do there, and I met women from all over the world. I mean, I met people from all over the world. I mean, people coming from Australia, people. I mean, it was a party time because they were volunteers is what they called us. And the thing about it was that if you see in Australia, people that graduate high school, they want to travel the world. in this country, you either get a job or go to college. And this is a lot of places. So these people were traveling. They wanted to travel for 2-3 years. They could stop off in Israel and stay there and live for free for 3 to 6 months and make their trip last longer, you know, and have a good time at the same time. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. You know, my family was sending me a few dollars every month. I had some money of my own that was coming to me every now and then, so I could live pretty good. I was smoking hashish every day, and I was drinking this whiskey called Sheva Sheva Sheva, which is like a cognac, and Sheva 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 is 777s, and I mean, I would drink bottles of that every day. I'd get up at 4 in the morning to walk up to work with the sheep, and these were milk sheep, so we milked them, and I'd walk up this hill, and I'd have a bottle already, and, you know, they left me there even though I was openly drunk, you know, and I worked hard. Then about 15, 16 months into the deal, I got busted for hashish. And it was about 20 grams, 22 grams, so, you know, it's not that big a deal here in this country, but that was a real big deal. And I had only lost my passport down in the Sinai Desert. I mean, I was down there drinking at an oasis. And the Bedouins, you know, you get drunk, you go to sleep, you hide your valuables underneath your head, you're asleep. The Bedouins know that trick, so they just come by and pick up everybody's wallets. I mean, you know, they take all your stuff. So I didn't have that. But I went to jail. I was in, not jail. I was in a little jail in Afula, which is a little town. And now it's a big jail for terrorists. But when I was there, it was just a little humpy little Western jail. And I was there for 2 weeks. But the people that I worked for in the kibbutz, they fought for me, and they got me out of jail. And I was able to stay in the country. But what they couldn't do is they couldn't let me stay on the farm that I was living on, because the children are the real important deal there. You know, the children are schooled in groups and don't stay at home a lot, and they didn't want my influence around the children. Now, the people that loved me didn't care, but for, you know, they had a group conscious. Everybody had a vote. So I had to go. So I left, and it cut my trip short because I only lasted 3 more months because it didn't feel the same everywhere else I was going. I came back to the United States, and my family, you know, 3 years gone away, you know, everybody wanted to see me, you know, that didn't last long, you know what I mean? Because when I got there, if I wasn't a real alcoholic when I got there, when I left there, I was a real alcoholic. You know, I was the 210-pound flushed, and now this is suntanning booth, this is not alcohol here. But I mean, you know, that, you know, pinched red, you know, rosea type of red on her face, you know, drunk skin. And I came back, and I was a real drunk, and hell, I was back 3 months, and I was selling furniture at a company named Levitz, which was, you know, it was like I died and gone to heaven. I came back, I was so fired up. I was thinking about how I'm going to tell my story. I was thinking, you know, a lot of people think I have this huge ego, and I have a healthy ego. I don't think it's that huge. I'm happy to be who I am today. And that's a big difference, because when you're drunk, you ain't happy to be who you are. And that's because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and coming to these meetings. So, you know, I feel good about who and what I am. So, you know, and as Rush Limbaugh says, if you can do it, it is an ego. So, you know, I kind of have a belief in that sense that, you know, if you can do it. Now, if you come from where I come from as a drunk and a drug addict and can turn your life around where you can effectively be part of men's lives or people's lives in a way that helps them, something unbelievable has happened. I think that's the spiritual experience. Mine is not a relationship with God. Mine is a relationship with people. I'm not a happy kind of guy. I don't like people. Generally, I don't like people. I'm not real. I'll tell you, I'm not real big on people now. But I have a lot of people in my life. And I'll do anything I can for them if they're working to help themselves. If they're not willing to help themselves, then I can't do anything for them. Because no matter what I do for them, it's not going to help any. Because it's not going to change who they are. So, where was I? Oh, so I came back, and I was in the furniture business, and I got just addicted to Quaaludes all over again. One more, the perfect example of the first Quaalude leading to the full-time hunt for another Quaalude. And I lost my job at 9 months, and I worked for Haverty's a couple of times, and by that I had a hard time getting Quaaludes. A couple of the Haverty stories, I worked at Haverty's, and one of the Haverty's was in South Lake,
Morrow, Georgia, and that it was a dry county. I had to take Law 5101 and pints and half pints underneath my seat, you know, to get there. And I got stopped by the same cop twice out there, you know, some different situations. So, it just goes on and on and on about this drunken and drugging. I wanted to tell a couple of stories. You know, I kind of like that thing, what's the guy that's does this TV show, If You're Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Jack Bosworth. You know, he says, if you're a redneck, if. And I kind of got at some drug and alcohol, you know, ifs. You know what I mean? So, if you are staying on the in a swimming pool in Las Brisas in Acapulco, Mexico, and you're naked, and you're drinking, and you get burnt to a crisp that you almost want to die, you're probably alcoholic. If you go up to Road Atlanta, and it's raining cats and dogs, and you're out there drinking and doing cocaine and sliding down this big old hill of bare ass, you know, enough to cut you up, really slither you up, you're probably alcoholic. I got a guy that, a good friend of mine named Stevie. I'm not going to mention his last name, but he's on camera the first name. And this guy loves me. He's about the only high school friend that I have that we're still keeping contact with. And we were at Lake Lanier, and we were on Quaaludes. I had an ounce of pot on the boat. We were drinking, and he fell out of the boat and almost died. I mean, somebody had to rescue him. And my boat, the little sailboat, not a motorboat, drifted into the weeds, you know, to the reeds or whatever you call those things, and they arrested me for boating under the influence. I mean, I wasn't happy about that. And possession of pot and possession of Quaaludes. Luckily for me, there was a Quaalude doctor. I'm going to leave that story out, but there was a time there was Quaalude doctors prescribing Quaaludes, so I had a prescription for it, so I didn't get arrested for that. But I got the pot charge and the boating under influence. The boating under influence was a lot more expensive than the pot charge. And it's that kind of stuff. It just goes on and on and on. I got a DUI on Peachtree Street near the tree on Peachtree. I had just left the place where I'd been snorting a ton of cocaine, but I'd been drinking a lot of Law 5101, because that's what I drank. That's, you know, unless there was some by mistake, we didn't have any of that, that's what we drank. But, or I drank, and I drank this 101. The officer that stopped me had somebody else in the car, in his car, and stopped me. Because the way I was driving, and he got me. This is crude, so you might want to cover your ears. He got me, and I shit my pants. And it was all free water, you know? I mean, it was no, you know, nothing solid or anything like that. And I didn't wear underwear in those days, you know? And he took me to Grady Hospital, you know, and because they wanted to do the check the blood test thing and get like that. So, I mean, you know, God almighty. I mean, really, there's literally hundreds of stories like that. You know? Because I was doing it every day. I mean, I had a couple other DUIs. The nice thing about DUIs is after you've had a couple of them, you learn to quit driving in the nighttime. You know what I mean? It's harder to get a DUI in the daytime, you know, so they don't have roadblocks and stuff like that. And, I don't know, anything really good left? Yeah, well, I got 20 minutes of that. Can't make it anywhere. One time we were at a frisbee throwing contest at Piedmont Park. We had a dog named Raz. Yeah, we had a dog named Raz, and so I probably had a couple of beers in my hand while we were throwing this thing out of Georgia Tech. And so I'm throwing the frisbee, and the frisbee dogs, it's the frisbee thrower that has to be good. The dog is not that big a deal, because the dog knows what to do. It's the frisbee thrower trying to get this thing on time. So I'm throwing the frisbee in this contest, and he's screaming at me for not doing it right. And the dog leaves the field and goes straight up to her. let me tell you how it comes to the end. In about December of 90, Doc's boss buys me a case of Law 5101 for my Christmas gift. So obviously, you know, these were quart bottles. Obviously, he knows I drink too. I mean, you know, normally, I mean, I buy my accountants every year a bottle of whiskey. I don't buy them, you know, a case of it. So he bought me this case, and I swear to God, I thought there was something going on between him and Dot, and that they were just trying to get me out of the picture. And, you know, I drank this stuff, and I was finished with it, like, you know, scared me. I mean, I was done with it by, you know, like the first week of January, you know, and I was a half-pint drinker, so I would stop at the store and get those anyway. So, you know, so I got that, and I got these quarts gone. So, I didn't think I had a problem, but a little while after that, I could no longer go to work. I just couldn't drink and make it to work, so I took a leave of absence. You know, so, I took a leave of absence. Doc's niece went and got my 401k check for me. I mean, she might have got that later. I might have already been smoking dope. So, but I went to a psychiatrist again, and they put me on Antabuse, they put me on Ativan, they put me on Antabuse, and I went batshit crazy. I mean, the Prozac and Ativan. I mean, I was as addicted to the Ativan as I've been addicted to anything else. And the Prozac wasn't helping me; it was hurting me. And then I had a guy that used to work with me. His name was Joey. And Doc used to own a house in southeast Atlanta. So when I was there, I never smoked crack cocaine. But, you know, as soon as I started smoking it, I knew where to go get it. And Joey lived in that neighborhood. And so Joey says, well, why don't you try this? You can't drink. You can't do this. I said, okay. I tried it. And damn bad mistake. I mean, it might have been the best thing that ever happened to me, but at the time, it wasn't a good idea, because once I took that first hit, I had to have that second hit. Once again, the allergy, it's a proven thing. One drink, 25 drinks. One hit, the rest is history. So I spent a long time chasing that stuff down. I got down to about 140, 150 pounds. I went crazy. I was angry as shit. I'm going to tell a story that Doc doesn't like, but I'm going to tell it anyway, because I gave her some forewarning. I took it to a bank which is now a SunTrust bank at Toco Hills, and we went in there, and I didn't have her by her hair, but I might as well have had her by her hair. I mean, I was screaming and ranting and raving. I was angry as shit. I needed more money. I wanted to know where the money was. And, of course, I wasn't working. She was. It wasn't even my money. You know, so, you know, but I dragged her into the bank to do some investigating, you know. And so we get into the bank there, and I'm telling you, Doc, she was okay with it. I mean, she was not happy about it. I think she's been madder on other occasions than that. But I'm going to tell you this, the poor girl that was in the bank was scared to hell. I mean, she it looked like a hostage situation. She was breaking out. But, I mean, that's how I used to get in a special case. I robbed my mom of $5,000 during that run. Hell, about 5 years earlier, she fell down, and I mean, she didn't fall down. She fell down. She fainted because she. You know, it might have been 10 years earlier. She fainted there. She found a couple ounces, maybe a pound of reefer. It might have been a pound of reefer. It was a lot of reefer because she couldn't get it flushed down the toilet. And she fell down, and I didn't even bother to pick her up. I went to go get the dope. Now, I'm not proud of that story, but it's just I want you to know what we do. So. I can go on for 3 hours on that stuff, but let me tell you about sobriety. And this is why I'm telling my story a second time. Okay, because I'm not the person I used to be. This is how there is too. I mean, I still do stupid shit. I ain't perfect. I ain't the most honest son of a bitch. But I'm going to tell you this. I don't drink. I don't drug. And I'm in service to my guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I have a message that works because I am sober. You know, Dot and I have this debate, you know, she talks about recovering alcoholics. I'm not a recovering alcoholic, I'm a recovered alcoholic. The book says that's what happens to us. I mean, I didn't get sober working the steps. I had divine intervention to get sober. Something happened to me. And I believe that everybody that goes one day from drinking to the next day not drinking, something has happened in their life. The only thing is how can we keep it? What can I do to keep that thing? Well, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is designed for. Remember what I told you when we started here, that I didn't fit in with you guys? Well, I tell you guys, if y'all are in here today and you don't think you fit in, y'all going to be in serious trouble. You know, I'm in serious trouble. And I got a lot of experience to back that up. Not just my experience, but other people's experience. Now, I don't like to talk about it, but I'm going to talk about it because it's too much a part of my life.
Dot and I have houses where recovering alcoholics and drug addicts live. You know, now I want to call it a sober living environment, but the truth of the matter is there's just houses where alcoholics and drug addicts live. You know, I'm not real big on treatment facilities. I'm not real big on halfway houses. I'm not, you know, I like a halfway house for somebody that can't afford it, that they say, go to AA, go to NA, go to CA. But if they're going to pass them out as treatment, I'm not into that. And that's how our house was started, you know. And what we did when we started houses was, wow, this, what a great way to accumulate some real estate, you know, housing alcoholics and drug addicts, you know what I mean? So, you know, but that doesn't work all the time because some of them say, hey, you know what I mean? So sometimes the real estate market takes a turn, you know. So, and I can't say how many months we put our own money into it, but I have gotten a tremendous amount of experience watching what other ants do. I'm about to have surgery in 2 weeks. I haven't taken the first painkiller. I haven't had a drug or anything since I got sober. And I had surgery in my head for a bone that was broken. I choose not to. I go to any lengths not to take that first pill because I personally don't think that I'm going to go back out and do dope over it because I've got too much of a support group. I've got too many people that are part of my network, people that's for me to do that. But I've seen people that have similar situations that take that thing, they start thinking differently, next thing you know, they forgot where they come from. Mm-hmm. You know, and next thing you know, they're back out there doing things. And we have watched, Mark and I were trying to talk, Mark's a real close friend of mine and real important in my life. We were talking about how many people have died. Not in our houses, but have died that have been in our lives that have lived in our houses. And in 2 years ago, we had three guys lived at the same address shortly after they left, within 6 to 8 weeks with them. And they were just alcoholics. I want to tell you from my experience that alcohol is by far the worst drug there is. I mean, it's cocaine, quaaludes, crack. Don't stand shit to alcohol. Says you don't see crack advertised on TV during the Super Bowl. You know, you don't walk down the grocery store and see Quaaludes in the bottles. You know, but you see alcohol everywhere you go. You know, it's the social thing that you can't turn the TV on without watching it. You know, it's there. You know what I mean? Why can't I drink? You know? But you know what? The beautiful thing is you know you're recovered when you don't give a shit about that stuff. It just don't make no big deal to you. And that you don't care what other people think about whether you're drinking or something, that you can go somewhere and you're not uncomfortable in your own skin. You know, I got here, you know, there's some people in the room that know me when I got here. There's some people in the room that know me before I got here. And, you know, the thing about it is I came in, let me tell you what the recipe was for me to get sober. I came in and I had a sponsor. There was two sponsors at this meeting in Northside Hospital, the two main ones. And, you know, you either went with one or you went with the other. And I went with one, okay? And he'd come to my house and take me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He would come to my house and read the Big Book of Alcoholics. I was thinking, what's wrong with this sucker? I mean, I could not believe this guy was taking time out with me to go through these things, you know, because I still, even though I made a decision on that night, it was about 9 months until the obsession left me. So he took me we read the book page by page, paragraph by paragraph, the same way I do it with the guys that I work with today. And read this book. When it says pray, we prayed. When it says rise, we rise. When it said fourth step, you're right. You know, we just pray through the book. It's not rocket science. So we did that work. But let me tell you what I did with that work. We did that work, but really where I was heavy was got involved in service work. Got involved with Cocaine Anonymous. I got volunteered at NAPA. There was a young lady, an older lady that used to sit on the wall. Her name is Beverly, and she's passed on. She was a wonderful woman. But what she did for me, I'll never forget. I was about a year and a half sober, and I was coming to the 11 o'clock meeting on a regular basis, and, you know, she hit on the younger guys with less sobriety. Not in a hidden way, but she liked us. And she asked me to chair a meeting here. And I chaired this meeting, and I felt much more part of the place than I would have that I never get done. I mean, she did me a great favor. I didn't even know I could speak in public without taking a drink. You know, I could not do shit without taking a drink. So she also had one of the greatest lines. They all love this one. She says, she thought lower company until she was one.
If you can relate to that thought, I related to it very well. That's just unbelievable. So, Cocaine Anonymous, I'm part of the service group over there. I'm going to these meetings, these things that they have, and I'm starting to tear the CIA hotline. I'm going to meetings. For about 5 years, I did a meeting on Saturday night at Georgia Mental Health Institute for Cocaine Anonymous. Now, if you can't go into Georgia Mental Health Institute, it's like any detox, every week for 5 years and not stay sober. You know, you go in there, you see the same drunks over and over and over again, and the first thing out of their mouth was, well, why did you relapse? I quit going to meetings. I quit calling my sponsor. You know, after hearing that for about 3 or 4 years, you say, you better call your sponsor and you better get a move. You know what I mean? So this is what I did. And I'm not ashamed to talk about it because I did a lot of service work. That's the deal. So I can tell you, I got a lot of people in here that think this is what I did. Now, you think it might be overkill, but you want to know something? I'm still sober, and it ain't overkill. I carried the CA hotline for about 4 years. Was it 4 years, Dad? I carried it for 4 years. I mean, I was on it 24/7. To every day of the week. I mean, I was on it. And I get calls at 3 a.m. in the morning, and I hear these people crying about their children. I hear about their girlfriends crying about their husband. I hear crying. And I just loved it. For me, it was like sucking in energy. You know, it was just powerful. And, you know, I tell a story, Mark, I like this one. Because this is what I used to always tell these people. You know, these people call them about their wayward children. They call them about their wayward spouses. They call them about their... I'd always ask this question. I said, do you believe in God? And what do you think everybody answered to that?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, how can you not answer that question yes? I mean, you just can't unless you want to be in a debate. They answer yes, but you know what I'd always followed up? I said, now it's time to start trusting that God. Mm-hmm. You know, because if you believe in God, then you got to trust God. You know what I mean? You know, Dot and I always had this debate about my belief in God and this or that. And, you know, I absolutely, before I got here, I did not believe. Now that I'm here, I do believe. But I don't have a face on my God. You know, I don't have any, I can't comprehend it. And, you know, I believe God's already done everything he can do for us. It's up to us to do our part. And, helping your fellow man is what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it's basic Bible Christian, you know, belief or Judeo-Christian belief. You know what I mean? And here they give us a great opportunity to do it. What more fun is to help another alcoholic if you're an alcoholic? You know what I mean? So, it's just too simple. You know, we want to make this thing complicated. I in the last 4 weeks, I've been to a synagogue and I've been to a church. And one of the guys I sponsored was doing a testimony, I think that's what they call, and he did a marvelous job, so that was my reason for being in the church. You know, we joked afterwards in the church, they were doing this and doing that. You know, 56-year-old, I thought they were at a concert, you know. You know, they had a rock band up there and everything like that. And, you know, and then last week I was in a synagogue. Well, hell, I like the church better. I think I'd go back. I couldn't wait to get out of the synagogue. But what dawned on me was this how... The society is so desperate for spirituality in their life. How desperate. And here we got it simple and easy. You know, you have to be a junkie or an alcoholic, come into a place, and there it is. Just boom. You know what I mean? We don't have to prove anything to anybody. You know what I mean? And we don't have to bring the band in. You know, we don't have to pay the rabbi a lot of money. You know what I mean? It's here. And it's, you know, I'm not saying, you know, if you got it as a sidekick or with this, you know, because I will tell you, this is my experience with the people in my houses, that most people that leave AA to go find God at the church end up back here, you know, with bruised knuckles, you know, I'm not speaking for everybody, I'm just sharing my experience. And also, anything that I shared about Alcoholics Anonymous is my opinion, it's not AA approved, because I'm not here to talk about AA approved. You know, I also had a problem past a couple of years ago, but all I want to say about that is that when things get tough here, you better know the word perseverance. You've got to know that word, because I'm going to tell you, when I'm down, I drug my ass into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, sometimes one or two times a day, and, you know, I just recently, for me, if you remember me telling my story last year, I was about 10 pounds lighter.
maybe 15 pounds lighter, you know, but I was a miserable, miserable duck. Today, you know, because of modern miracles and meditation, and now I'm doing it through prayer and meditation, that is, but, you know, through that, and with competent psychiatrists, I'm actually fairly happy today. And, you know, that's the joy of living, is to be good to your fellow man and be happy at the same time. You can't beat that. So, you know, today we're going to have a question and answer period afterwards. I don't know what else to say. It's just that Alcoholics Anonymous has been very, very good to me.
Thank you.
Wisdom of Baba Hare. Okay, seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, donations, support the group, and AA its own. I've asked Leslie to get up to... Well, okay. He's got an overwhelming desire to give out chips. Hi, Jesse. Come on.
Hey, Jesse. It marks your sobriety time. First chip we offer is the white chip. We call it the surrender chip. If anybody want to surrender to the process of Alcoholics Anonymous, we offer you this white chip. It's the surrender chip. Okay, then we have the silver chip, which is for 30 days. 30 straight days. And I do have some more. We offer the 30-day chip. Next, we have the red chip, which is for 3 months, 90 days. 90 straight days. Next, we have the yellow chip, which is for 6 months, six straight months. No takers. Next, we have the green chip, which is for 9 months. 9 months. We offer it. After 9 months, you're well on your way. We offer you the blue chip, which is 1 year and multi. 1 year and multi.
My name is Larry R. All my friends call me Doc. This is 19 years. One day at a time, going to meet, have a sponsor. I do a lot of service work. Congratulations, Harry. Good deal. Thank you. I needed to hear that. I needed to laugh. And above all, I'm a member of the No Matter What Club. You know, no matter what. 2 years ago, my son was murdered, 25 years old. November, Thanksgiving, my mother died. 2 months, 3 months prior to that, my uncle passed. And out of all of that, I didn't sit necessarily to pick up a drink or a drug. So this program works. Thank you. Amen.
I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. 9 years. I heard Harry's story. Me and Harry are real close. I'm one of the guys who deal with Harry's house. And I'm proud to see it too. But I know this though. Me and Harry was in Charlotte Peaceful at the same time in 91. Charles, like Harry, I don't like none of y'all. I'm a very sensitive person, stay to myself. I'm a Vietnam vet. And I hated the world. I hate the world, and I'm loneliness myself. I stay lonely. But today, what I do, I'm a volunteer at the VA hospital, and I do service work at the VA hospital. And I've been doing that for 13 years. And that's a blessing in my life, to see another addict, or especially a GI, that gets straight in his ass up. You know, I love this program. Alcohol, and plus I go AA, CA, NA, any kind of aid to save my ass, I go. I'm blessed. I want to give this a chip to somebody, a new person that walked in today. A new person in here who got left in 30 days. Come on, get broke.
Anybody else for any birthday? Hey everybody, I called in here at my very first AA meeting, was right here in this group, and that night the speaker, haven't laid eyes on him since, but for 13 years he had sobriety, and he talked about his start drinking beer and smoking out in the woods with his buddies, and I was the guy that supplied him. He kept my buzz going when I was like 16 years old. And I picked up my white chip, and I met Tim Moore that night. That was the first time. And he told me, we really need you. And I really needed to hear that at that time. It meant a whole lot to me. And he's been my sponsor. And now I've got 619 days coming up today.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Wow.
They said, pick out your sponsor, and somebody's got what you want. And Tim is a man comfortable in his own skin. And I'm proud to give him my chip back. He bought me a second chip after I lost my first one. Yeah, there you go. Give it back to me.
I'm Tim, I'm an alcoholic. Hey,
Tim. Tim, this is 6 years.
All right. All right.
You know, we started, I got to start working with this meeting 3 years ago. Tim does most of the heavy lifting now. But I'm more excited about this meeting now than I've ever been, I for sure. And Harry, I love Harry because he's Harry. Anybody love Harry. But the first time I met Sam Harrison, we talked for a while, and I said, what's the difference in people that stay sober and don't? And he said, commitment. And I've never forgot that. And Harry, for me, you are the gold standard of commitment, and I mean that. And everything else I've been taught is temporal, good times, bad times, money, no money, whatever, whatever. But no matter what, I've never seen Harry waver in his commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I love him so much. And I really try to watch him and put a lot of things in my life. But I love y'all. Thank you for being there when I got here. And Doc, well, it's good to see you. I didn't know you were here tonight. Big company, so thank you.
Once again, any more birthdays? Let's get them out.
Spencer, I'm an alcoholic. January 19th, this is my sobriety day, 24 years tonight.
Woo!
Harry, thank you for your story. Always inspirational to hear it, and, you know, you summed it up pretty aptly. It's clean house, trust God, and work with others. You know, it's pretty simple, and that's how I wouldn't recommend anybody do it my way, because my story, I've got a lot of ups and downs in it, but I did stay sober, and I have stayed sober, but you know, it all comes back to trust in God and being able to use that to help others and to pass this thing along. So, good to see everybody.
Did anyone steal Lurky for a birthday? All right, then, we're going to do this. This is the only chip we offer twice. I'll offer it again. And if you're ashamed to come get it, through this program, I truly believe I can bring it to you. Anyone wants it? Thank God for the chips you bring.
Do we have any AA-related announcements?
I'm telling them now. Thanks, Harry. The best. Next Monday night, same time, same place. Sissy R. Amazing story. She's from the Gwinnett Room up in Lawrenceville. 20 years sober. You don't want to miss it. So trust me, you'll be glad to hear that.
Yes, Mark.
My name is Mark, an alcoholic. Hey, Mark, I'm a teacher in the literature cabinet. Anyone like any AA literature after you didn't see that?
Yes, sir.
My name is Frank. I'm an alcoholic and addict. I'm from the Dogwood Club, and one of our members, Gary Williamson, and I don't know if anybody here knows him. He's been to a number of the groups. He died on Sunday, and we're holding a memorial service on Tuesday at the Dogwood Club at 7 o'clock. So if anybody knows Gary and would like to join, please come down.
7 o'clock. Dogwood.
At the Dogwood Club.
Thank you. All right. I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Mark Holmes. Mark Holmes. Take a step.
I have to decide it. For the alcoholic, man, y'all still suffering. And children don't have to say so it matter. Talk about a Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. And give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, and as we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
I work it every day.